What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Today we focus on Iran, where so-called peace talks with the United States have failed, and the U.S. president has ordered the U.S. Navy to implement a blockade targeting ships connected to Iranian ports in the Strait of Hormuz, accusing Iran of extortion by restricting the vital waterway. Y'all hear the exhaustion in my voice with that assertion. We'll also look at Israel's assault on Lebanon, where strikes by the colonial power has murdered at least 2,055 people and wounded 6,588 since March 2nd. And Israeli bombing and raids continue. Israeli aggression has displaced 20% of Lebanon's population in less than a month. 1.1 million people in Lebanon, including more than 390,000 children, have been forcibly displaced. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said military operations in southern Lebanon will continue, including inside the so-called security zone. Joining us to discuss all of this is Dr. Usama Magdisi, Professor of History and Chancellor's Chair at the University of California, Berkeley, and Faculty Director of the Program in Palestinian and Arab Studies. He is the author of several books, including Age of Coexistence, The Ecumenical Frame, and The Making of the Modern Arab World. Good morning, Dr. Magdisi.
Good morning, Kat. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you back on the show. We're going to start with Iran and these so-called peace talks. Before I ask you some questions, though, let's listen to this clip of VP J.D. Vance.
We've had a number of substantive discussions with the Iranians. That's the good news. The bad news is that we have not reached an agreement. And I think that's bad news for Iran much more than it's bad news for the United States of America. So we go back to the United States having not come to an agreement. We've made very clear what our red lines are, what things we're willing to accommodate them on, and what things we're not willing to accommodate them on. And we've made that as clear as we possibly could. And they have chosen not to accept our terms.
The Vice President J.D. Vance in response to the so-called peace talks in Islamabad halting. The United States says it's Iran's fault. Iran says, the United States is being unreasonable. And I actually want to start with the sticking points for Iran, not the United States.
In terms of what the sticking points are?
For Iran to be like,
Well, I mean, I'm not, of course, I'm not following the negotiations in the details that others are, because we don't know all the exact terms. But what has come out and the reports that have come out are very clear that the U.S. has insisted on maximalist demands. This is what all the information that I'm getting is that the U.S. are basically demanding that Iran give up not just all nuclear weapons, which Iran, of course, says it does not have. But they're also demanding an end to all, the Iranian nuclear program, which would be, of course, from the Iranian perspective and from the perspective, as far as I'm aware, from the perspective of international law, would be a violation of Iran's sort of rights. And the Iranians have been very clear from day one. I mean, for years, they've been saying they don't have a nuclear weapon. They don't have an active nuclear military program. Whether one believes them or not is a different story. But the reality is that they have a right to have a nuclear civil program. And so that's where the talks appear to have foundered. The U.S. seems to be making all these demands from a position of what the U.S. considers to be strength, although the reality is, as we've seen over the past month, over a month, is that the world economy is teetering, the damage has been immense, of course, primarily to Iran in terms of the civilians, in terms of the infrastructure of Iran, in terms of the military of Iran, as well as Lebanon, as well as in Palestine. The damage has been immense for people there, first and foremost, but of course for the entire world as well. All for a war that, as you, Kat, you've been following, you've been saying, a war that was waged by Israel and the United States on Iran.
And I think, not for nothing, and this is commentary more than a question that you're free to respond to or not, right? And so now the United States president is having a temper tantrum, a military temper tantrum. They've implemented, as we heard in news headlines, they've implemented a military blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. And to your point, right, like this isn't just gas prices for folks in the United States. We're talking about damage to massive infrastructure that rely on this fuel, like agriculture and medical needs. So your everyday people, right?
Of course.
Are feeling the impact of Trump stomping his feet, yeah?
Yeah, this is not a war that's in the interest of everyday people. This is not a war that's in the interest of the United States. This is not a war that's in the interest of people of the Middle East or in the Middle East or around the world, quite frankly. And you can see that the vast majority of the world, in fact, I would say the entirety of the world other than Israel, is in fact deeply opposed to this war for obvious reasons. The damage is evident before us with the inflation, with gas prices, with diesel prices, with... And it's going to get worse if this continues in this way. It's pretty clear. So I don't know when the U.S. says, when Donald Trump says that he's going to blockade the Straits. I thought the whole point was he wanted to open the Straits. I mean, now I'm completely confused. But that seems to be the nature of U.S. Official U.S. policy vis-a-vis the Straits of Hormuz and this war. That the objectives seem to change every single minute. And it was all based, of course, on a fraudulent claim that Iran was on the cusp of having nuclear weapons that were going to be used in some way against the United States. And that, of course, is absurd.
I think what is driving some of the confusion, but which then, I don't want to make light of it, turns into violence that civilian people are experiencing every day. And we're going to get to Lebanon in a minute, is that there is that the ultimate objective actually isn't to open or close the strait. It isn't actually about nuclear power or not. It's about the expectation of colonial powers that those that they are trying to colonize sit down, do as they're told, not resist.
Yeah, there's no question that I'm sure that's part of the thinking. I mean, the U.S. has waged war on all sorts of peoples around the world. But the reality is that in this instance, the U.S. Has miscalculated in terms of, I mean, I'm talking about the official U.S. because remember, we have to always bear in mind and emphasize the fact that the vast majority of the American people are not with this war, quite frankly, because everyone can see this was a war that was waged illegally on Iran by Israel that pushed the United States into this war. And there's a debate, of course, to be had, you know, whether, you know, to what extent was it Israel pushing the U.S. or to what extent was it the U.S. military people who knows. But it certainly seems like it's Israel that pushed this war. And it's clearly not in the interest of ordinary people, whether they that how that then translates into how the U.S. officially thinks about non-Western peoples and non-white peoples is certainly something that we should bear in mind.
Okay, Professor Mantisi, we're going to go ahead and move on to Lebanon, where Israeli airstrikes have continued across the southern region, even as strikes around Beirut have eased in recent days. Amid reported U.S. pressure ahead of expected talks, I want to get to that in a minute, Israelis are targeting healthcare workers. Lebanese officials reported an attack on a Red Cross ambulance that murdered a paramedic and wounded another. To the brief earlier point, but I'd like to go more deeply. Can we talk about the impact of all of this on the people of Lebanon, the humanitarian
crisis? Of course.
That people are living through?
Yes, and this is personal to me because, of course, my parents live in Beirut, and my brother lives in Beirut, and my niece lives in Beirut, and my aunts live in Beirut, and so I have family in Beirut, and I have relatives, and so, and they are, you know, like millions of others in Lebanon, are enduring this extraordinary situation of unbridled Israeli savagery. In terms of the assaults on Lebanon, in terms of the, this is a continuation of what they were doing in Gaza, what they had been doing in Gaza that you've covered, that everyone knows who's had eyes to see and a phone to look at and can scroll through various sort of social media can see what the Israelis have done to Gaza. It's a genocidal war, a genocide that has obliterated Gaza, that has caused immense suffering and violence, that has purposely targeted civilians, hospitals, universities, schools in Gaza, and they're doing a similar kind of thing. I just got the statistics now from the Lebanese Ministry of Health, today's statistics. And statistics today, thus far, according to the Lebanese Ministry of Health, 2,089 people have been killed, over close to 6,762 have been wounded. There have been 88 in the health sector alone, 88 doctors, nurses, first responders have been killed by the Israelis. The Israelis have wounded 195 of these people in the health sector. They have damaged or destroyed 25 medical and ambulatory centers. They have attacked, of course, vehicles, ambulances, as you just noted, and they're shutting hospitals down in parts of the country. This is a deliberate attack on the civilian infrastructure by Israel, following a well-trodden path by Israel to target civilian infrastructure as part of its total war against the people whom it opposes, quite frankly.
I did not know you had family in Lebanon. Sending you and them lots of care.
Thank you.
If I would like you to go maybe, Dr. McDesey, a little bit deeper into the parallels between Gaza and now Lebanon. If we were going to, say, chart, right, a path of expectations based on what happened in Gaza, what path are we charting?
Well, I mean, it's a very dark and grim path. I mean, it's quite clear. And of course, it all depends on what happens on the ground ultimately. But right now, I mean, the Israelis have been explicit about it. The Israeli officials have been absolutely explicit. They want to create what they call, of course, this anodyne security zone or a buffer zone. But in reality, what that means is that they want to ethnically cleanse the south of Lebanon. As you noted in your introduction, over a million people have been displaced. Of course, people, you know, like us, like any people, like us as normal people, civilians, you know, nobody wants to be in harm's way, and everyone wants to try to get out and save their families, especially having seen what the Israelis have done in other places. And so people naturally and inevitably, you know, try to move to safer areas. And what the Israelis are doing is that they're in Lebanon. It's a very clear policy, Kat. They are deliberately attacking the Shia population in particular, because the Shia population of Lebanon, which is, of course, the largest single community in Lebanon, are located in the south of the country, in the southern suburbs of Beirut, in the Bekaa Valley. And Hezbollah has emerged from within that community as the primary resistance organization in Lebanon. So the Israelis, to destroy Hezbollah, are going after the Shia population. That is exactly what they did to the Palestinians in Gaza, when, in the name of fighting Hamas, they devastated all of Palestinian society in Gaza, as we saw over the past 3 years. And in both instances, the common thread, of course, is not just a will to attack civilians and civilian infrastructure, to literally terrorize civilians in order to sort of defeat what they consider to be the resistance organizations that the Israelis hate and oppose deeply. They are using, of course, in both instances, U.S. weapons that our taxpayer dollars go to fund in both instances. Because of the impunity of Gaza, the Israelis feel they can do what they want in Lebanon. The difference is that now in Lebanon, there's a much more sort of powerful resistance organization, although, of course, it doesn't have an Israeli air force. It doesn't have nuclear weapons the way Israel does. It doesn't have a navy the way Israel does. It doesn't have unlimited U.S. support the way Israel does. But there is an active resistance on the ground, and the Israelis are not able to advance deep into southern Lebanon as much as they would like to. So there's very bitter fighting taking place in the south of Lebanon. But what we've seen, the videos coming out are very clear. The Israelis are literally blowing up entire villages along the border with Lebanon as they try the scorched earth policy of trying to make southern Lebanon uninhabitable, in much the same way they made Gaza uninhabitable. The tactics are similar.
I want to, because you touched on it, so I was going to do it later, but I think you touched on it, and because they're going to be more and more in the news, that we should have some accurate history about Hezbollah and political conditions that gave birth to the resistance group. And I'm wondering if you can start with the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon.
I mean, yeah, as a historian, I mean, one always, I say to students or to anyone who asks, basically, in the end, you have to look at the history of this and understand that Israel has invaded Lebanon in my lifetime. It invaded Lebanon in 1978 for the first time in a major way. It then had a much larger invasion in 1982. And in both those invasions, 78 and 1982 of the 20th century, of course, I'm talking about, Hezbollah didn't exist. Hezbollah emerged in response to Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. That is crystal clear. Every single person who has the most basic familiarity with the history of the Middle East will tell you this. And it emerged in response to Israel's invasion, because the Israelis, when they invaded southern Lebanon in 1982, going all the way to Beirut, by the way, and besieging West Beirut, where my family lives, or what used to be known as West Beirut, The Israeli army was very brutal to the people of the south of Lebanon, and they inevitably didn't want to have an occupying Israeli army, you know, in their midst. And so Hezbollah emerged as an indigenous resistance organization tied very clearly tied to Iran, in the sense that the Iranian revolutionaries, the Islamic Republic in Iran, very clearly ideologically, financially, politically, and militarily helped and was crucial to the emergence of Hezbollah after 1982. But when people describe it as a proxy of Iran, they miss the chronology. The reality is that Hezbollah emerged primarily because of Israel's invasion of Lebanon, and primarily because Israel occupied and brutalized the south of Lebanon and people there. And then Hezbollah emerged in response. And of course, the US and the Israelis describe Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. But the reality is that the picture, when you take Lebanese politics and history into account and the reality on the ground, the picture obviously is very different.
As states also call the Black Panther Party a terrorist organization, Black Lives
Matter. Called all sorts of organizations.
Any organization. I'm not lessening the impact of it. I'm just connecting dots for folks. Any people of color that have the audacity to assert their humanity and resist colonization
Exactly. And the whole point of calling somebody a terrorist, irrespective of who that is to stop people from thinking. Just you say terrorist, and that ends the argument, and that's the point. There's no history, there's no context, there's no nothing. It's just, you're a terrorist, end of story. And therefore you deserve what you get, basically.
And we really saw that play out in this country, right, post 9/11. And we haven't quite reset in terms of racism, prejudice, stereotypes of the Arab world and the power of that word to shut people down to anything else.
Yeah, and the point, of course, in Lebanon, Hezbollah, is that there is, in Lebanon itself, there is obviously, one has to be honest, there's a very deep debate. There are a lot of divisions in Lebanon. A lot of people in Lebanon don't like Hezbollah or are opposed to Hezbollah, especially when you start fracturing it along communal and class lines. People are a lot of people don't support Hezbollah, especially outside of the south and other areas of the country. But nevertheless, nobody would say, Hezbollah doesn't emerge out of history, out of a very particular context. And that context is Israeli colonization that precedes Hezbollah. And that's the crucial point.
For the folks in Lebanon that don't support Hezbollah, what is the path? Like, what is the political pathway? What are the alternatives? Where would folks like to see their government, let's be honest, right, doesn't really have the resources to do much in the midst of all of this?
Well, I mean, there's a paradox, or the irony, or the tragedy of Lebanon, is right, as you just put it there. I mean, the people who oppose, there are many different reasons why people oppose Hezbollah. So it's a very complicated debate, which I can't get into all the details here. But in essence, or in summary, or in sum, the reality is that some people oppose Hezbollah because they say they want a sovereign Lebanese state, for example. That's what they say. They all constantly assert this idea of sovereignty, and therefore, if there's a sovereign state, the state should have a monopoly of violence, and there shouldn't be a resistance organization that's not subordinate to the state. That's their argument. But of course, what they don't answer is that, okay, that's fine in theory, but in reality, the state and the Lebanese army are completely incapable of defending Lebanon or the people of Lebanon. Totally incapable. And it's not because there aren't brave or you know, decent people in the Lebanese army, because there obviously are, but it's that they don't have the equipment. And when you ask them, so why don't they have the equipment? Well, because the U.S. And before the U.S., the French would not sell or give the Lebanese army the equipment to defend itself from Israel primarily. But also because many people in Lebanon, the Lebanese government, didn't see the army's role as one that's there to defend itself, defend the country from Israel. So it's a complicated thing. So that's one argument, the sovereignty argument. The other argument is, I think, a slightly more pragmatic argument, because the sovereignty argument doesn't carry much water, because in the end, the Lebanese state and the Lebanese army is not protecting its people. Therefore, it's not exercising its sovereignty. The other argument that carries, I think, more weight and is more pragmatic is that people say, and I'm sure you've seen this, Kat, here in the US, with the Black Panthers and other organizations as well. People will say there's no point resisting an overwhelming military force, because if you dare resist, you're going to be crushed. So we're better off not resisting and just dealing with, in a sense, accepting the overwhelming military power of Israel. This is what some people will effectively concede. Because if we try to resist, we're going to be obliterated. So we'd rather live, and even if it's under unequal conditions, than be obliterated. And then you have people who say, absolutely not. And we are going to resist because this is our land, and we're going to, that's what they say. And we're going to, and we'd rather, because in the end, if you don't resist, they say, the Israelis will transform southern Lebanon into the West Bank, basically, into the northern bank, and will colonize it and take it. And the Israelis have long had designs on southern Lebanon up to the Litani River to annex that whole region to what is, in effect, a greater Israel project. So, I mean, there are different perspectives.
A little bit more history that draws a parallel to right now. Historically, what has the relationship been between Iran and Hezbollah?
Well, I mean, Hezbollah exists in the sense it's, as I said, people describe it as a proxy, but that removes all the agency of people in Hezbollah and the fact that it grows out of a Lebanese indigenous environment in the south of the country and the Bekaa and other parts where there's a Shi'i population. A Muslim Shia population. And so there's two aspects to this. There's the indigenous aspect, and then there is, of course, the relationship to Iran. So Hezbollah ideologically is committed to the Islamic Republic. In other words, it itself says it openly. It doesn't hide this fact that it's tied militarily, financially, politically, ideologically to the Iranian government. There's no question about that, and so it's this double relationship. There's a relationship with Iran, without which the Hezbollah could not exist in its current form, and there's the fact that there are the organic conditions in the south of the country and in Lebanon itself that gave rise to Hezbollah. And there were other resistance organizations, by the way, in Lebanon. There were secular organizations, there were other Islamic organizations, but there was a host of secular organizations, whether communist organizations, whether Arab nationalist organizations, many different Syrian nationalists. There were so many different organizations that engage in resistance, but Hezbollah emerged as the dominant force by the late 1980s.
And be patient with me, Dr. McDC. I am learning as I go.
Sorry if it's complicated, because Lebanon is also
I just some of my
place.
Questions I know seem super basic. I mean, that's in part for my listeners, because I really want people to be able to connect the dots beyond the headlines. And to be honest, it's also for me.
Most important dots to connect is that there was no Hezbollah when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982.
Yeah.
That's the most important dot to understand, that Hezbollah emerged in reaction to Israel's occupation of Lebanon, the same way that Hamas emerged in response to Israel's occupation of the Gaza Strip, the same way that the PLO emerged in response to Israel's colonization of Palestine. I mean, it's very clear where the chronology is ultra clear on this, and it's very important to keep this in mind, because here they like to start everything by saying it's only when the colonized people respond or react. That's the date. That's the starting point of history right there. And there's no history prior to that. And that's what one should push back against constantly.
Yes. And we saw that effectively done with October 7th.
Of course. Absolutely.
And in Palestine. All right. And part of the apologies, because some of the questions I ask, I know, are repetitive, and some
that's
of them okay. Maybe like, what? Okay. So given the weakness of the Lebanese army, right, the Lebanese government has been in talks with Israel, did agree, and I had Samer Arabi on around the time this happened. We both sort of went, did agree to disarm Hezbollah. I don't know that anybody believed that was going to be possible. So here's the question. Given the weakness of Lebanese army, why would the government agree to try and force Hezbollah to stand down or disarm if they are the most effective, and we can get in the rebuild post 2024 in a minute, response to Israel? Does the government Is the government part of the group that you were talking about that was just like, why resist?
Yes, of course. I mean, that's part of it. But also, I mean, the government in Lebanon is divided, and there are Lebanese society is divided, and Lebanese politics is divided. But those who actually run the government, in other words, the prime minister and the president, now are very much in a pro-Western orbit, a pro-American orbit. And they very much see the idea that Hezbollah, they look at Hezbollah as for them, a more as far as I can tell, because I'm not, of course, talking to them. It's not that I have any inside information that I'm just reading the news and following the news.
Read your analysis. It's all good.
Yeah. and so basically their position is this very formalist position that there has to be one Lebanese sovereign state. And of course, at one level, that makes sense, but you have to be a sovereign state to assert sovereignty. And so what they're doing is that, we know Lebanon has the second largest, as far as I'm aware, U.S. embassy in the world. And the largest is in Iraq, if I'm not mistaken, in Baghdad. And you know, this is not a Lebanese government that actually is effectively sovereign. This is a Lebanese government that is pleading, quite honestly, with the United States and with its Arab patrons, Saudi Arabia, others, to basically, they were essentially begging the United States to get Israel to stop its attacks on Lebanon. And there is nothing is effective, because you can beg all you want. The Americans are not, the United States is not going to, at this point, as we can see, it is not putting any kind of real pressure on, as far as we're aware, did not put any pressure on Israel to stop its over 15,000 violations of the ceasefire that the Lebanese government entered into with Israel between November 2024 and the end of the ceasefire in February 2026. Over 15,000 Israeli violations. The Lebanese government pleaded and pleaded, not zero effect. So they feel that their future is tied to the U.S. and the Arab states, and the Arab states as in Saudi Arabia and others. And so that's what they feel their future is. And they look at Hezbollah as tied to Iran and therefore as a rival. And that's the idea in a nutshell.
Okay. Lebanon's parliament, the folks you just talked about, the new president, Joseph Aoun, and Prime Minister Nawaf Salam, right? They were elected in January 2025. And they promised that things were going to be different. They promised, as elected to do, a new phase in the country. They promised reforms to the judiciary. They promised reforms to the economy, state institutions. Yes.
But I mean, look, Lebanon, the state is incredibly weak. It's like, I think at some level, some of these promises, probably they it's not just them. It's like the previous to them. Virtually every government comes in and promises to do better. But Lebanon is a place that where the state is extraordinarily weak, where there's extraordinary corruption, where there's a sectarian form of government. In other words, there are positions that are effectively reserved for one community. In other words, the president has to be a Maronite Christian. The prime minister has to be a Sunni Muslim. The head of the army has to be a Maronite Christian. The Speaker of Parliament has to be a Shiite Muslim, and so on and so forth. And these are all sort of, these all originated in informal backroom deals dating to 1943. And in effect, the Lebanese system is extraordinarily unequal. It's extraordinarily corrupt. The state infrastructure is essentially non-existent. The state doesn't provide electricity for most people. It doesn't provide clean drinking water for most people. It certainly doesn't provide defense for most people. It's not able to. It's not capable of. There was a huge financial crisis a few years ago in Lebanon, where people's savings, all their life savings, were all sort of lost. Were basically stolen, in essence. And nobody was prosecuted, as far as I'm aware. Nobody was seriously prosecuted for the theft. I think the central bank governor was arrested. I think that's the only person. But so far, there's been nothing has happened. So people are basically left to their own devices. To put it, that's again why Hezbollah emerges. Because the whole point, if there's no state and nobody's able to protect you, nobody's able to care about you or do anything about you, even if they want to, well, then inevitably, somebody comes in to fill that vacuum.
I just a few minutes left with you and Dr. McDeasy, and I can't do an episode without some talk of Palestine, where the genocide continues in both Gaza and the West Bank.
Yeah.
Even though the headlines are dwindling, and that's sort of the scary part. One of the scary, there's so many scary parts of this moment, but that's one of them, is that we get so distracted and we forget to keep our eyes on Palestine.
Well, Palestine is there. I mean, the whole point of what's happening in Lebanon is because of what happened in Palestine. If Israel was able to get away with the mass murder of thousands, tens of thousands of people, including children, and the starvation, the deliberate starvation of millions of people, including children, and if it was able to get away with the destruction of every single university in Gaza, every single one, and the bombardment of hospitals to the point, and the killing of journalists, more journalists than any other part of the world. If Israel was able to do all this, and the Western world, the powerful Western world, in other words, the United States, Britain, Germany, France, all to a state led, of course, by the U.S., not only said nothing and did nothing, but ultimately rewarded Israel with a constant supply of military weapons and support. And in this country, as we know, a huge crackdown on our ability to think independently, to be critical, to bring history into the discussion. All that, we've been censored and attacked and intimidated, or these attempts at censorship, attacks, intimidation, defamation. All these are happening at the same time. If we don't understand that, we don't see that if Israeli genocide is not stopped or held to account, well, then they're going to repeat the same thing. And that's what they're doing in Lebanon. And that's what they've been doing in Iran in terms of bombing universities. It's the same playbook over and over again. This has to be stopped. This is unacceptable from a human point of view, from an ethical point of view, from a moral point of view, and above all, from a point of view of anyone who actually cares about the region.
The tagline of this show, Dr. McDeasy, is expose, agitate, and build. So when we talk about the build part, talking about building movement, building resistance, building the world that we actually want to see, as woo-woo as that sounds to people in this moment, we can't take our eyes off of that, because otherwise, what is the point? What is the point of this conversation? What is the point of people in the streets? What is the point of any of us, any of it? It has to be stopped. We all agree about that. If you were the big honcho in charge, and you could wave a wand to make people act right, as we say in my community, what does that look like? What is stopping this, all of it, look like?
I mean, that's a really good question. That's a hard question. All I can say in response to that, Kat, is that each of us can do more, and each of us can do whatever we can do. And as someone told me once, a little bit is better than nothing. So everyone has to do what they can do. And the reality is that you can see what's happening on the ground. In this country, even, there's a huge sea change taking place, a generational sea change in terms of people thinking about Palestine differently, in terms of people realizing that the U.S. has been led into this war. This is a deeply unpopular war. It's not that people necessarily care, but not about Palestinians or Lebanese, but even that's changing, because the more people are exposed to the reality of the mass depravity that's taking place in the region, the killing of civilians, the targeting of civilian infrastructure, the killing of doctors, of journalists, of children. This is unacceptable by any measure to any people in the world, no matter who does it. And quite frankly, I think the more we keep our voices going, the more effect there will be.
I guess I also look, perhaps not naively so, at world powers. You mentioned that world powers like France were not willing to provide Lebanese army with military supplies.
I mean, no, they give them military. They just don't give them, like, they don't give them anything. It's both they don't give, and the U.S. government at the time, which is pro-Western, doesn't necessarily want, this is what I'm led to believe, doesn't necessarily want this advanced weaponry.
Where I'm going a little bit with this is I'm waiting for the world powers to say enough is enough. You know, we look at the Strait of Hormuz. Like I said, I think to Phyllis Bennis, I was like, at what point does France go, I ain't had nothing to do with this. What do you mean I have to pay $2 million every time I want one of my ships to move through? I don't have nothing to do with the nonsense of Israel and the United States. Not that they would use those words, those are my words.
Well, the European powers, I mean, the interesting thing is to see how, I can't even call them European powers anymore, but the European states actually have, and Asian states for that matter, people are actually urging the U.S. to end this war, because in the end, it is affecting them. I mean, everyone can see, everyone understands that as the price of petroleum goes up, as the price of diesel goes up, as the price of fertilizer, as a shortage of fertilizer increases, as all these things increase, well, that puts huge pressure on the global economy. And this is an interdependent global economy, whether we like it or not. The reality is that, and you notice these states are not going along with the U.S. Now, there's a reason why there's far more criticism of the U.S. now, not just because the U.S. launched this war with Israel, but because they're being affected. And so I think the pressure is going to increase, in fact, on this particular thing, because they're hurting in the end.
Dr. Mike Deasy, what have I not asked you that the people need to know in this moment?
And just remember that when the headlines tell you that Israel strikes Hezbollah positions, understand that what they're talking about ultimately are people on the ground in Lebanon, including, like in Palestine before that, we're talking about human beings, including, of course, many, 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 mostly civilians. They're people. And that there's always people on the receiving end of all these bombs. And I think your audience probably knows that, Kat, but I think it's really important to always emphasize and insist upon this. Don't be deceived by these extraordinarily dehumanizing headlines, and think beyond the headlines, which is what you do, and I thank you for that.
Okay, really, truly, last question. Humanitarian aid in Lebanon exists? No, doesn't exist? And we probably...
Yeah, I mean, no, it does exist. There are extraordinary organizations in Lebanon, like the Red Cross, the Lebanese Red Cross, and other organizations, the civil defense. I mean, there are all these people who are doing extraordinary work in Lebanon, and so the Lebanese are going to survive this. I have no doubt about this. On the other hand, the toll is enormous, and this toll is directly because of Israeli impunity. That allows Israel. I mean, this war would have been over had the U.S. just stuck to the idea of a ceasefire that encompasses Lebanon. The Israelis refused that ceasefire. And so as a result, here we are. Yet more people are being killed every single day. We have civilians being killed and massacred in Lebanon. And I hope this will stop. But in the meantime, I put my faith in the resilience of Lebanese and Palestinian people to resist this onslaught.
All right, Dr. Mutisi, I'll let you get on with your day. Thank you so much for joining
us today. Appreciate having me. Take care.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.